Good afternoon and welcome to the October meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Diana Negroponte. She's a non-resident senior fellow with the Latin American Initiative under the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. Her work is devoted to research and writing on Latin America with particular emphasis on security issues in Mexico and Central America. Previously, Diana was a senior scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She received her doctorate from Georgetown University. Her dissertation then examined efforts to make peace at the end of the Cold War in El Salvador. She played an active role with the Chamber of Commerce in Mexico during the negotiations for the North American Free Trade Agreement. She has spent a lifetime devoted to social and development issues, particularly in the developing world. In Uganda, she taught blind children mathematics and music. In Honduras, she worked actively with refugees displaced by the civil wars from two neighboring countries. In Mexico, she built low-income homes in city slums with Habitat for Humanity. In the Philippines, she dedicated time to microcredit programs throughout the country. So we're lucky indeed to hear her insights in a talk entitled Beyond Hugo Chavez, Venezuela and its Neighbors Confront New Challenges. Please.
Good morning, and thank you, Tom, for that introduction. And thank you, James Allgrant, for ensuring that I made it to your meeting this October, because you may recall I was your speaker for the last Monday in June, but Atlantic storms prevented me leaving Washington, and so I sat on the tarmac while Tom and Sally DeMarco ate my supper. I never made it to their lovely home, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm very pleased and happy to be with you here today. And I have just taken a wonderful walk up the top of the hill to the lookout to see the beauty and grandeur of Maine's outlook across the Atlantic. I come from the other side of the Atlantic, and I felt closer to home. I have been asked by your organizers to talk about Chavez and his successor, President Maduro, but I can't do that without taking you back into some historical basis and placing the current turbulence, stories of no toilet paper, and stories of Chavez into some historical context. I'll get back to toilet paper later. Venezuela was the leader of the effort in 1811 to break away from Spain and to succeed in a 10-year war of independence. And Simón Bolívar, who becomes the hero of Hugo Chávez, was this Spanish-educated young man from a Creole family who led the forces not only of Venezuela, but of Colombia, Ecuador, and parts of Peru. So he is a hemispheric figure who defeated the Spaniards and who helped create the Grand Colombia, which was the successor to the Spanish Empire. It then subsequently broke up into the nations that we know today. But it's important to realize that, to remember this, because Hugo Chavez's ambition was to be the 20th century Simón Bolívar. And whereas Bolívar fought against the Spaniards, Chávez would fight against the Americans, the North Americans, us. And both share this intense nationalism and the use of the foreigner as a foil, because that's what Chávez did with the US. When things got tough at home, distract and plague the Americans. But there's a later part of history which is also very important for us to remember, and that is 1836. Well, let me think. Yes, I will start with 1836, but it's a bit later. Economic nationalism. If you recall, the West Europeans were in Latin America, and of course, in part to be missionaries, but principally because Latin America had sources of iguana, silver, gold, sugar, which Europe needed. And so the development came from external forces, and in response to that, economic nationalism said, we will develop our economy on our own, and you foreigners, go away. And so this strong economic nationalist ideology, which so dominated the 19th century, returned with Hugo Chávez and found a welcome base, found a willing ear among the Venezuelan people. Chávez was a hero, and even today, a recent survey found that 78% of Venezuelans believe that Chávez was a great leader. So despite Bloomberg News, Fox News, CNN News, to the people of Venezuela, Hugo Chávez was a hero. Now, he's a hero in the Latin American sense of a populist or a cacique, which is the name used. That is, he came from among the working class. The traditional elite rejected Chávez as an upstart. He was mestizo with more Indian blood than Spanish blood. He was uneducated. He was from the agricultural area, and therefore the elite of Venezuela rejected him. But by joining the army, this man found a way to use his abilities and to meet his ambitions through his ascent through the military ranks. And this is very typical. Juan Perón did the same. In Peru, we have leaders too, who use the military and the military's recognition of meritocracy to rise in their society and to acquire the status that regular society would have never have given him. Chávez did that. And so Chávez, emerging post-economic nationalism, but in a country where this extraordinary oil wealth was divided, was distributed so unevenly, uses the military to come forward and to say, I am a man of the people, I come from humble beginnings, and my language is your language. Your songs are my songs. Your chistes, your humor, your mine. And as a result, working class and peasant Venezuelans said, he's one of us. And not only is he one of us, he's now in a position to make decisions for us. Instead of generations of Venezuelans who have robbed the country of this oil wealth, this man will give that wealth back to us. We will see it in housing, education, health, food. And this explains why a man who led a coup with two other colonels in 1996, for which he went to jail, gets elected as president in 1998. This is a man by popular election reaches the pinnacle of Venezuelan power. And this is a man who remembers that if he can satisfy the economic needs of his base, the majority of Venezuelans, he will bring them out of their poverty or low middle income status and show them the grandeur. But as power accumulates, he not only saw his constituency, the people of Venezuela, he saw instead, as did Simon Bolivar, that there was a continent awaiting his message, and a continent ready to receive the benefits that the Venezuelan oil could provide. Venezuelan oil fields are the largest in this hemisphere. Venezuelan oil fields discovered in around 1915, 1917 are greater than the Gulf of Mexico. And that is the richness which Chavez recognized would enable him not only with the power of his speech and the power of his personal trajectory to become famous. And so he creates this organization known as the Alianza Bolivariana, taking Simon Bolivar's name, because this alliance would be a socialist alliance for the benefit of working class men and women throughout the hemisphere. And it would be supported by the oil resource, the wealth of Venezuela. Now, all of us in the room know that wealth lasts for a while. And if you don't reinvest, and if you don't maintain, and if you don't keep up with modern technology, you exhaust it. And this is what's happened to the Venezuelan oil resource. Venezuela in 2000 exported 1.36 million barrels of oil a day to the United States. They now can export to us 835,000 barrels a day. That's still a lot, but it's close to 500,000 barrels a day less because they are exhausting the wealth upon which the Bolivarian socialist dream is based. And that's the fundamental problem for Venezuela. There is an ideological goal, but the means to carry it out can no longer depend upon the oil of Venezuela. Chavez, as you know, dies earlier this year. And Chavez, before he died, made a very important alliance for Venezuela. It was an alliance with Fidel and Raúl Castro. And under this alliance, Venezuela would provide 90,000 barrels a day to Cuba. Cuba needs this oil. Cuba can no longer rely on the Russian, or formerly Soviet, oil. Petroleum, and therefore for Cuba, Venezuelan support and daily provision of that oil at subsidized prices is critical to the survival of the government and the people of Cuba. So when Chavez goes off to Cuba for his treatment for cancer, that alliance becomes even closer. And the Castro brothers identify for Hugo Chavez, his successor. You will choose that man, Nicolas Maduro, because he's a friend of Cuba. There were other candidates, but they were not friends of Cuba. And Cuba needed to ensure that with the continuing flow of that oil, a friend led Venezuela. So back in December, Chavez identifies as his successor this man who was the foreign minister. This man who, as foreign minister, had begun to discuss resuming diplomatic relations with the United States. This man who had displayed to the Colombians, a pragmatism and a sense of purpose, which led us all to believe that under Maduro, relations with Venezuela would improve. They would be put on a pragmatic footing. Ideology would become less important, and progress, as we understand it, would ensue. But Maduro has turned out to be different. Maduro, the pragmatist and foreign minister, has assumed the economic nationalism of the 20th century. And he has also assumed this anti-foreign, anti-Yankee, as a distraction for the problems, or as an explanation of why blackouts are frequent, burnouts are constant, the bottlenecks in delivering energy, electricity to the people of Venezuela. Let me just turn to my next set of notes. Tell you what I would love. If there's a glass of water, it would be helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much. To the listeners on the radio, I'm getting a bit of a frog in my throat. Thank you. Oil prices have risen. And that has provided Chavez, and may provide Maduro too, with the means to engage in major projects: housing, low-income housing, improvement of hospitals, availability of clinics for the care of children and the aged, and access to schools, and the creation of one of the world's great youth orchestras. Every young Venezuelan with a talent for music will receive free of charge an education in music with an instrument of his or her choice. These orchestras are led by some of the great conductors of the world, and they perform not only in Caracas, but they perform in Houston, in Hamburg, in Tokyo. So this wealth that has been generated has enabled a generation to be recognized as great musicians. But as I've said, as oil wealth depletes, where do you go? Before I go to the Chinese, who have enabled a continuity of these social programs, I need to become a bit financial. In Caracas today, the official rate for one US dollar is 6.3 bolivars. But if we walk out of the bank and go down to a money changer or go to Rite Aid, we will pay in October 2013 50 bolivars for one US dollar. In other words, the gap between the official rate and the free market rate is now wider than it's ever been. Venezuelans got used to living with two exchange rates because back in 1986, they were introduced to it during the oil boom. The problem came when a president of Venezuela called Carlos Andrés Pérez introduced the single rate, because overnight the value of the Bolivar fell by 9 times. And back then in 1986, it was 40 Bolivars to the dollar. Today it is 50 Bolivars to the dollar. Now those with the capacity to travel take their airfares to Miami or Houston and with their credit card purchase the maximum allowed, $2,500. They purchase that at 6.3 to $1. When they get back to Venezuela, they sell those dollars at 50 to 1. In other words, they manipulate the foreign currency exchange. And this produces great resentment in the country, and the manager of the finances and of those financial rates is an individual who is under extreme pressure to make dollars available to buy necessary goods and to keep inflation down. The finance minister is in the most vulnerable job of all, because inflation is now somewhere between 45 and 49%. And any of us who go out to do the weekly shop and would see inflation at that rate would have the fears which other countries have had in times past. It's unsustainable. Combine this with the fact that 70% of basic goods, sugar, coffee, chicken, soap, are now imported into Venezuela, mostly from the United States, and mostly paid for with that oil money, means that individuals are finding it very difficult to make ends meet. However, there is an exception. And the exception are these state-run stores called misiones. And in the mision, there is available those staples: cooking oil, sugar, chicken, coffee, soap, available at highly subsidized rates. So when I meet the mother of a gentleman who's doing repairs on my home and she's over visiting, she tells me I have no shortages. And I know that she has the ration card which enables her to take advantage of the misiones. And the misiones now have a big picture of Hugo Chavez above the front door, so that the provision of those basic supplies, together with the figure of this hero Venezuela, are joined. She will continue to vote for Chavez and his successor. But for those who don't have the ration card, for those who must rely on the local grocery store, empty shelves, including no toilet paper, has provoked this mixture of ridicule and concern that both the people of Venezuela and foreign observers feel. I never knew we'd be so worried about Venezuelan bums, but we are. So what's the way forward? What can Maduro do in the face of all this economic challenges? And I'm going to suggest that there are 4 ways. How's my time, by the way? Perfect. I'll keep within it. The first is China. China has extended loans to Venezuela to the tune of 36 billion dollars, principally into the oil fields, so that China can be assured of 600,000 barrels of oil a day. That's how it's paid. It's loan, and they're paid back in oil. But the loans have also gone into agricultural projects, housing projects, hospitals, healthcare, as well as funds for the use of the president, what we would call a slush fund, but which is considered to be a presidential fund. The Chinese are businessmen. The Chinese may not be in a hurry to be repaid on that 36 billion, but they want to be paid. This is not charity. And therefore, when on September 22, Maduro went back to the Chinese and said, having little trouble back home, can I have more money, please? He was granted $5 billion in a new loan, but the terms of that loan and the terms of repayment on that 36 in its various other components have not been disclosed. And I would assume that the Chinese have sought to exert certain controls over the use of those funds, particularly those which go into the central presidential fund and which are so obscure that fraud and manipulation can be used. Radio listeners, I'm taking another glass of water. Thank you. China is important for Venezuela. And when I met with the Assistant Secretary for Latin America in the Chinese Foreign Ministry this summer, I asked him, how do you reconcile your extended loans with the economic problems in Venezuela today? And he was very clear. Venezuela is extremely important for us, and we will do all that it takes to ensure that the Venezuelan state continues. In other words, the stability of our investments and the assurance that we shall be paid for our loans and our investments is critical to us. I did not get into the ideology of the Venezuelan government. I focused on the economics. Now, there's a second alternative for Maduro, and that's the narco trade. Colombian cocaine is exported to Venezuela, and on the Colombian-Venezuelan border, it's turned into paste, and then it's shipped to West Africa and also to Europe. 1.4 tons of cocaine were found on a Air France flight 2 weeks ago. That's a heck of a lot of cocaine. That follows up previous finds of cocaine being shipped through Venezuela out to the market. Some of that cocaine stays in Venezuela. Most of that, those proceeds go to the military, because the military have quite a handsome business. And it's therefore in the interest of the military for Maduro to continue and to avoid the opposition winning, which might start investigations, court cases, sanctions. So the military, having been allowed to play in the narco game, or traffic is better, have a direct interest in continuity of the present system. So Maduro is no longer concerned with a coup from within the military, because he has enabled them to get very rich. So when you hear stories about coups, be skeptical, because those who would carry out the coup are getting very wealthy under the present system. So let's turn to the third of the five ways forward, or the four ways forward. And that is to gather a degree of control in the presidency, in the executive branch, so that any opposition which may be coming from a legitimate opposition party, a legitimate party called the MUD, the Mesa Unido de la Democracia, known for short as MUD, M-U-D, ensure that they cannot win. And there are elections at the municipal level coming up in December. So Maduro has created two new organizations. And I'm now looking at my notes for those on the radio. The first is called the Strategic Center for Security and Protection of the Homeland. And that combines together the intelligence services, the armed forces, and the militia. And that is designed to ensure that citizens are not in cahoots with the opposition, that there isn't a growing opposition. In other words, there's a close observation of citizens. The second is the higher authority for the public's defense of the economy. And this is to ensure that hoarding is not taking place, because with this dysfunctional exchange rate, the opportunities for hoarding are enormous. And therefore, citizens are being called upon to check the warehouses and check the storerooms of stores and individuals to ensure that all that toilet paper isn't stored somewhere. These organizations bring together parts of the military and parts of the militia, because you must remember that 500,000 young Venezuelans, not those in the orchestra, but others, come together on a monthly basis for training, for the use in weapons, firearms, to parade, and to demonstrate their loyalty to the government. And they are known as the militia, and they all wear red shirts, and they're a force that we should not ignore in it. So you have this concentration of power, each of these new organizations which respond to the president. Now let me take the third, which is the judiciary. The Supreme Court have identified that the leader of the opposition may have misappropriated some funds or may have not followed the regulations correctly in his campaign, and therefore there's an investigation against him. The purpose is obviously to instill a degree of caution in the opposition. The prosecutor general, what we'd call the attorney general, has brought a case against half a dozen members of the legislature, once again for misappropriation of funds. The purpose is for those legislators to vote with the majority and not with the opposition, because Maduro needs 2/3 majority to pass the decree which gave him executive authority. Executive authority enables him to rule by decree without passing through the legislature. Chavez did it on 4 occasions, that 200 decrees which Chavez passed, and Maduro now seeks to use the same constitutional means of ruling, but obviously with effects which could be very dangerous should his decisions result in the economy deteriorating further. So it's a decision he may regret in the future, but meantime, concentrated power. The last is the diplomatic, and it goes back to what I was talking about, the anti-foreign, whether it be the anti-Spanish or whether it be the anti-American. And earlier this month, the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires, Kelly Kittling, the political counselor, Councillor Elizabeth Hoffman, and one other, had to leave the country. Their diplomatic status was removed, and within they were given 48 hours to pack up and leave the country. And the grounds for doing this were the following. The political counselor had been visiting the state of Bolivar, a state in which there is strength among the opposition, and she'd been talking with opposition figures. But also while she was there, she talked to people who probably knew how the electrical grid worked and probably knew how the electrical system was transmitted, and therefore she is to blame for sabotaging the electrical grid. The US is once again behind it. It was ludicrous, but it provided a distraction as the three were photographed leaving the country. In response, three Venezuelan diplomats have been asked to leave the country, including the Venezuelan chargé d'affaires, who was the man considered the pragmatist to be able to restore diplomatic relations, Calixtico. And that is a loss for us, because if ever there was a man with whom we could have a pragmatic discussion, it was Calixtico, but he's back home. So what do I see in the last 2 minutes? What do I see as the future? One, further devaluation of the Bolivar with a consequential rise in inflation for the people of Venezuela. Two, an estimated fall in the price of oil over the next 6 to 8 months, not because of what's happening in Venezuela, but what's happening in other parts of the world. We're talking about $70 to $75 a barrel, which will have a major impact on the Venezuelan economy. And finally, an increased reliance on the Cubans. With that realistic note, I abandon the podium.
Thanks, Diana. I must say it sounds sort of dreary living in Venezuela, and the future doesn't look very good. So let me ask you, here's the first question about the future, which draws on your last points. No coup, the military co-opted, domestic intelligence. How will the Venezuelans ever break this Chavez-Maduro rule?
There's no clear answer, and a solution must come from within. It's the Venezuelan people who have to find a way to break this stranglehold.
All right, here's another one. Is the decline in oil exports to the United States, does that represent the decline of the oil fields? Are they drying up, or is it because of Venezuelan inefficiency?
Both, but it is the inefficiency which resulting in less product, less petroleum coming out of the Orinoco fields, and a reluctance of the international oil companies to invest in fields, in blocks which are available, but which regulation and payments that must be made make it less interesting for Luke Oil and other international oil companies to invest in.
Okay, how about, and this goes back to that first question, whatever happened to Venezuela's so-called elite who were powerful at least prior to Chavez taking over?
There are three futures for them. One is in Houston or Miami. Another is to be co-opted. In other words, you stay in Venezuela, you keep your mouth shut, you send your children to school in bulletproof vans, and you hope you can survive. And the third elite have joined the Albar and joined the Maduro clan. They have clearly moved with the current tide.
All right, this relates to the Cuban-Venezuelan relationship. Considering Cuba's own internal problems, how can they be so much help to Venezuela?
In return for those 90,000 barrels a day, Cuba provides doctors. And these not are doctors who are working in the air-conditioned hospitals of Caracas and Maracaibo. They're working in rural areas and providing health care to people who previously had to travel miles to get there. And we have to really be very grateful to the Cuban doctors for doing that. But there are other Cubans. There is an agency which registers the identity of every citizen, a little bit like those of us who've got global entry now. We've given our biometrics to the government because we like to get through security faster. Well, it's not to get through security faster. It's order that security know who you are, and that system is run by Cuban officers. So the Cuban medal in Venezuela to an extensive degree due to this collection of ID and identity cards. And of course, if you want your ration card for the Mission, you must provide that information, and it is foreigners who are collecting it.
Okay, continuing on the Cuban question, looking at it from the point of view of the United States, what has been our response, the American response, to the uniting of these two important Latin American Latin American countries, in effect against the United States? What are we doing?
We're very pragmatic. Neither Venezuela nor Cuba present a threat, direct security threat to the United States. Yes, we would like to stop them to stop exporting the cocaine. There is no doubt we have a drug interest in cooperating with, in working with the Venezuelan government. But otherwise, we observe it, we watch it, the State Department is aware of what's going on. But since there is no identifiable direct threat, there's nothing we do, and the State Department would have liked very much to have resumed a pragmatic diplomatic relations at the ambassadorial level. That's out the window for the moment. But if a chance ever came up, we would seek to resume at ambassadorial exchange of ambassadors.
And this is sort of a follow-up to that. From your experience in Washington, do you think there are, and talking to people in the State Department, are there lessons from the Chavez experience and, in effect, the way Venezuela has become so anti-American that we could look at and use to avoid this happening to other Latin American countries in the future?
You did say Latin America, but what was going through my head is if we can ignore Chavez and Maduro, why aren't we ignoring Assad? And the answer is Al-Qaeda is in other parts of the world. And Al-Qaeda is not in this hemisphere.
That's about the only good news that I've heard today, Diane. Here's a personal one. Are you persona grata in Venezuela?
I haven't tried to get there.
How about this one? Let's look at the ecological problems. Are there any in Venezuela due to the extensive development of their oil resources?
It's a very good question, and I'm afraid I don't know.
Okay, we'll move back to politics then. Are there possible, and this is similar to a question that was asked earlier, are there possible local heroes, people that are particularly popular, who could rise to unite the Venezuelan people in politics?
There is a young politician called Enrique Capriles Radonski. His parents emigrated from Poland. And he has succeeded in drawing together the opposition and in nearly winning that election, that presidential election of April this year. He is a charismatic, well-educated, very handsome man who has accumulated 14 different parties and tendencies together. He was successful in April of holding the opposition together, which is very hard. Now, the question is, when you lose an election, which he claims he did because of fraud, but once the election's over and the president's in, there's no point in banging on about that. Can he hold the opposition together over the next few months? Can he hold the opposition together as the next elections approach in December? If he can, if the opposition, the coalition drawn together in this MUD or MUD, if he can hold it together, then he is an alternative. If, however, there is a fragmentation among the opposition parties, this will really challenge Enrique Capriles Radonski's leadership.
This is a question about other possible exports of Venezuela. Does Venezuela have any things that it can export at a profit besides oil? And in terms of imports, why has the Venezuelan government, under Chavez, obviously, now under Maduro, been so incompetent that it has to import stuff like chickens and toilet paper, et cetera?
Oil is a curse, because when you have such a single source of wealth, you don't diversify. And so if you were to ask me, I'd say, well, yes, there's some trading in cattle with Colombia. Yes, there's rice to the hemisphere. But it's nothing compared to this oil exports on which five generations have come to rely. Now, imports. Why be importing sugar, rice, cooking oil? The answer goes back to this exchange rate and to price controls. If a farmer is told you can only sell your cattle at a fixed price, next year that farmer will not be selling cattle. And the following year that farmer will not be producing cattle because he cannot cover his costs. So take that into rice, sugar, vegetables, as well as the cattle and poultry, and you produce an artificial economy in which the producers have no interest in selling.
Okay, how about we're going to try to move a little bit beyond Venezuela. This question is, apart from Venezuela, how do other Latin American countries today, we know what Venezuela thinks of the United States, how do other Latin American countries view the United States and view particularly the Obama administration?
It's changing. The people of this hemisphere used to look up at the United States with great respect, and that respect is declining. And our political problems and the economic crisis of 2008 have had a direct impact on the leadership and the people of this hemisphere. This is not to say they're not lining up for a visitor's visa or come shopping. That still happens. But the United States is no longer the most influential country in this hemisphere, and a significant, serious effort to diversify, to look for alternative markets, allies exists with both Asia and Europe.
to expand on that, I mean, the Brazilian president just canceled her trip to the United States because we've been eavesdropping on her, and the Mexicans are upset about it. Are other Latin American countries equally upset about it, or were they probably assuming that was happening all along?
Well, we've yet to hear which other leaders have been, their personal telephones have been listened to, or their discussions with their political colleagues have been listened to. But I would anticipate that there will be a response equal to the Brazilian. I must make a distinction. The Brazilians were truly angry. Dilma Rousseff was herself imprisoned during what we call the Dirty War by the generals, and she knows what a society in which the authorities listen to conversations is like, and she will not accept that. Mexico, on the other hand, was tame in its response for two reasons. It needs the United States. 82% of Mexicans' exports come up here. And then secondly, Mexicans listen to Mexicans' telephone calls. No gentleman's accord around there.
Okay, back to the narco trade. Is the military similarly corrupted by narco interests in other Latin American countries and some of Venezuela's neighbors the same way it is in Venezuela?
That's a very good question, and I would look to see what's happening in Ecuador there. I'm not aware of it in Colombia. Colombia, as you know, has had an 11-year terrible war with the FARC, which is a guerrilla group with ideological purposes, but also paid for all of this with drug money. But Colombia's cleaned up its act. Ecuador, not so sure.
Okay, this is the last question, and before I ask it, I really want to thank you, Diana. I think you've answered about 20 questions, and you do a wonderful job. You answer them precisely, you answer them quickly, you don't repeat yourself. I wish a whole bunch of our past and future speakers could have heard what you have done today. It's been quite remarkable. The last question is, are the Chinese primarily interested in Venezuela because it is a thorn in the side of the United States, or because of the oil it provides to China?
Chinese interest is primarily for economic purposes. China's rate of growth makes it the largest market for international oil in the world. And Venezuela, being the principal producer of oil in this hemisphere, is a ready supplier of oil to China. So when you're looking at Chinese investments in this hemisphere, think trade. The fact that it may irritate us a bit, no harm, but that's secondary.
Again, thank you very much. It's been great. It was certainly, from our point of view, worth waiting for. I'm sorry that you have to spend all that time on the tarmac, but I'm glad you gave it another chance. It was wonderful, Diana. And here, to take back to Washington, I have to tell you, you're not the first person in Washington to have one of these very famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug. But thank you very much. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much.